All right. Congratulations, parents. Way to get in. Oh, all right, Tom. Hang on. Give me the big wave. Hang on. Get in here. Sorry about it.
I was just here I am to save the day.
Save the day. Was Mighty Mouse, was he racist? Should we get rid of him?
I don't think so.
Some of those old, I don't know.
I'd like to look at some of those. I used to love cartoons.
Yeah, me too. Oh, by the way, I started to say, I saw you waving to me through the door. Congratulations, parents there in Redmond, Lake Washington School District, holding feet to the fire, getting a cute kid to read something about you need to be back in class. Good for you guys.
You hate manipulating kids like that.
Oh, look at Sean's back. Hey there, Sean.
Yeah.
How about you, huh?
Hey, guys.
Oh, okay. Wow.
He's an equine expert now, right?
He is. He took almost 2 weeks off to learn more about horses. We appreciate that. We'll find out what the story is with the teeny tiny lady in the pickle jar. We'll get to all of that. But first,
the highlight of our show this early.
Yeah. All right. Here he is. Yeah, he is. That's your cherry pie right there. All right, Sully, with news. This is a piece that you wrote for My Northwest, just talking about the fact that Sound Transit is really bleeding. They have not enough cash to move forward. They haven't moved into the emergency plan yet. What's the euphemism that they use for, what is it, non-affordability or unaffordability?
It's an affordability gap. As opposed to a deficit or a revenue shortfall. It's an affordability gap. It's like a temporary refund adjustment.
That's
a Simpsons reference. Yeah.
Yes. So they're looking around for some cash that might be available somewhere, right?
Yeah. They're basically what they're looking at is an $11.5 billion shortfall in their revenue projections based on what we've been talking about for the last year. I mean, no one's the sales tax that funds them is down, farebox revenue way down. So they're projecting out that they're going to be in a world of hurt to produce what it is that they promised the voters. So the board met last week, the Sound Transit board, and they've got a really tough choice. And we've been talking about this for a year now is, okay, where do you get the money? What do? Do you cut projects? Do you delay projects? Do you build them in phases? They're already going to the federal government to try to get some money from the feds there. Peter Rogoff, the CEO, has already met with the Biden administration folks under Pete Buttigieg there at the Transportation Department. And they're also trying to lobby Olympia to get some state funding. You may not realize it, but Sound Transit does not get virtually anything from the state in terms of funding. It's all based on the tax revenue and farebox revenue. And they also have two options to go to the voters, one of which I did not know they had the authority to do. And that's, I wanted to highlight that these are all the options that are out there. The one that's more likely to happen is they might go to the voters and say, listen, will you let us take on more debt? You know, you pay the tax for longer, but if you let us take on more debt, we should be in better position. The other one is they actually have an employee head tax possibility. They have the authority to go to voters to ask for a $24 a year per employee tax for the entire King, Pierce, Snohomish County taxing authority to go forward. That one's not very likely, but I didn't even know that was in their arsenal.
That they're in a taxing authority that, and they got them, did they get this in the 1990s or 93, 94, somewhere in there, that they said, okay, if you guys need to raise funds, you are allowed to tax people.
Yeah, back in 1990, this was actually the state law that was passed, and I've got the RCW linked at mynorthwest.com. If you want to read it, tells you all the ways that they can raise
Give us
money.
The RCW right now, Sally, so we can get over
I don't have it on the top of my head. I really don't.
Go ahead.
I actually don't. It's like 108-31-something.
No, keep going. Go.
But, yeah,
merge onto this topic.
The thing is that I didn't realize, and even Bruce Dammeyer, who's the Pierce County executive and one of the board members, like, we have a head tax? We can do that? And so even he didn't sound like he knew that this was something that had been set in law 30 years ago for a potential funding mechanism. Now, it's so caustic that Sound Transit has never used it because they know what it would do to the business community that supports them. Nobody in the business community is not going to want a per-person employee tax, and the business community has usually supported sound transit. It also doesn't raise a ton of money. I mean, $685 million sounds like a lot to you and me, but when you're down $11.5 billion for the pain in the rear to get this thing to the voters and what the backlash might be, you may not get the money you want out of it. So it's not likely, but I just wanted everybody to know that it's a possibility.
So this $11 billion number, is that how much they've lost in this one calendar year?
No, this is
expected revenues. Where's that number come from?
Basically, when you get $54 billion in ST3, Tom, right?
Right.
They don't just get a check for $54 billion on day one. It accrues. You keep adding. And so their forecasts are, okay, every year our ridership is this, our sales tax revenue is this, and they project out to the end of ST3, which is 2041. Based on what they lost or what they didn't get last year. It's not like they've lost money. It's just that the revenue they're anticipating to fill up that 54 isn't coming in, nor do they expect it to. So it's not like, you know, I don't open up my wallet and I'm missing money. It's the money I was going to get next week is not there either. So
how far? So what, they have many options, or they at least they have a couple. They can delay. They can push it further out. They can ask to take on more debt. I guess they can do that through bonding. They can also then say, well, you know what? We were going to do this sort of thing. They could just start to move their projects and make them smaller or less, I don't know. They still have to connect all the different pieces. They have like three or four different things that they can possibly do on this thing, right, Sully?
Yeah, I mean, well, if you think about when they came out of the Great Recession, they had a, we had a similar thing going on with ST2 at the time. Yeah. And so that's, you know, getting us to Northgate and whatnot. And so maybe you don't get exactly the amount of stations that you wanted, or you don't get a full parking garage. They made some choices there on what to cut back. So they have similar options this time as well, as you go from, you know, from Linwood up to Everett, or from the Federal Way area down to Tacoma. They've got options to trim back. They also have options to delay. If they get no new money, one of the projections I saw in the in the board meeting was West Seattle might be pushed back another 7 years. Ballard could be pushed back another couple of years. And so they don't have a very enviable job, but they've got a bunch of criteria. They're looking at it. They're going to figure out the best thing they can do going forward to try to deliver what they promised to voters and try to keep solvent.
Yeah. Okay. So you were trying to scare people with the head tax.
Well, it's just interesting.
It's good. That's not what you were doing. Yeah. Interesting. Quote unquote. It's just interesting.
Hey, got you to read the article and put me on at 306, didn't it?
Get out of here. Get out. Horse, hockey, hunky, whatever it's called. Thank you, Sully. You know, Sean's ears perked up when I said horse pocky or pucky. He knows all about horses now. Alrighty. George Floyd's trial starts. Is that they pick the jury on Monday? Is that what's happening, Tom?
Yeah, next week. Next week. So it hasn't quite. These are sort of the preliminary moves now. And next week they'll start the jury selection. And they expect once that is settled, they expect it to take 2 to 4 weeks. So if we're in March now, by April, I would guess we'd have a verdict.
The big news is that the judge said, yeah, you know what? You want to have it on TV? Yeah, we'll put it on television.
Yeah.
The prosecutors first said they didn't necessarily want that. The judge said, no, that seems like a good idea. So this would be similar to the OJ trial, although when OJ's trial went on and on, we didn't have social media. And I remember reading an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal the day the verdict came down, which I think was like 11 o'clock or something like that on, I forget what day it was, the least number of phone calls. Remember reading this, Tom? That phone, people on the phone had dropped to the lowest it had been or something like that, or similar to what it was like at 2 o'clock in the morning, that everyone was just glued to the television set. And no one, hey, oh my God, I got to hang up with you. Hang on, the verdict is coming down. And everybody watched. And remember Judge Alito became like, whatever the guy's name was, he became like famous for having a whole bunch of crap on his desk. And he really got caught up in that he was, became sort of a star, a celebrity.
Jay Leno had the dancing Itos.
So I don't know what happens with this one, but certainly this will be an extremely overhyped and then much watched trial as they pick the jury. There were some cases that I think the defense said, hey, we'd like to have it out of Minneapolis and send it somewhere else. But if you were to look at the courtroom or the courthouse right now, it is completely surrounded by barbed wire and fences. They're getting everything in place, and the jury gets picked. The big case will be from, I guess, the Wall Street Journal was looking into the particulars of the how hard it will be for the prosecutors to be able to make their case.
Yeah, this is really tricky. It's a good legal analysis of the steep climb, the steep challenge, I think Wall Street Journal calls it, for getting a conviction here. It's a second-degree murder conviction or manslaughter. Because of the prone restraint is what they call it when a coach, I mean, when a cop is pressing your knee, you know, on your back, on the suspect's back. This was up on his neck, and there's some dispute between it's okay to do it on his shoulder, maybe not the neck. Others say yes, it's okay. But what they've done, what Wall Street Journal did, was look at the instances of prone restraint when something bad happens to a suspect when he when the officers are using prone restraint. It's almost never going to trial. That in a lot of cases, in many cases, the judge just throws it out, says, no, that's a legal or legitimate use of force, if he determines that. I mean, you could obviously do it and it not be proportional, but in most cases, it's decided as proportional. And if it's not, if it actually gets to the point where it's going to go to a trial, they say there's this famous case in New York where it was settled for like $1.5 million to the estate of the suspect who then died. In that particular, but it goes through, and it's like, I think a lot of people thought, and in fact, at the time, I went back and sort of scratched my head about whether this was legitimate or not, the use of force by Derek Chauvin, because I remember, and Wall Street Journal did this article, that a lot of the top, like the heads of the sheriff's organizations and the police organizations, national organizations, says that, yeah, what he did was beyond the pale, that that's too much. And yet, so, you know, that was sort of the consensus, it seemed, of other law enforcement officials looking at particularly what Derek Chauvin did. But then when you read this latest analysis of how hard this is going to be in prosecution, it sounds like that's not a given. That's not a gimme that he indeed went beyond. The argument that's being made is that you can use prone restraint until the person is under control. And when the person stops resisting, then you're supposed to get off him. That's the argument that the prosecution is going to make, that they think that he hadn't moved for like 3.5 minutes of the 8.5 minutes. There was no, not even any movement. He might have been dying or dead at that point. Yeah. That's the argument they will make in prosecution. And the defense will say, no, you know, that this was allowed. And based on the Wall Street Journal's article, I've got to say, I think it's going to be a 50-50 call
it's
at best
be hard.
That he'll
they
be convicted.
Probably,
yeah.
They could have done with third degree. Second degree, this is what they have to prove, is generally defined as intentional murder that lacks premeditation. So the officer didn't leave the house that day saying, I'm going to go out and kill George Floyd. Right. It is intended to only cause bodily harm or demonstration extreme indifference to the human life. But it is still, it's intentional murder. So I stayed on his neck to murder him. I didn't leave the house to go murder him. But when given the opportunity to murder him, I murdered him. They have a thing called, I think, a 619 or I can't remember the exact number. But Minneapolis has in its code, you can also charge with racial or bias intent as well. That's almost like they would throw in there sort of a hate crime. That would be something they would layer in on top. They didn't charge him, the officer, with this. So they're going to have to try to show that he knew by staying on his neck that he was killing this guy. Third now, degree, he would be more likely to get away with it. They will not be able to prove this. And then the streets of the United States and possibly across the world will erupt in flames, and people get an opportunity to get themselves some new sneakers and some flat screen TVs.
Okay, now I want to go back because I don't know what you're looking at. In the Wall Street Journal of reference, it says that they don't need to prove that he intentionally killed Mr. Floyd. What they have to prove is that he intentionally inflicted substantial bodily harm.
Yes.
Well, that's right. Different. That he's... That, but that's right. Different but than, I... than trying to prove that he intentionally tried to kill him. All he had to do is establish he intentionally inflicted substantially bodily harm. That intention ended up in the man's death, but that's not the end.
Right.
That's not the end result of what he was intending. Yeah,
right. But they also in Minneapolis, you are allowed to be. You can have that guy in that position, and you can place your foot or your knee back in that. It gets just a lower part of the neck. So the question gets into. When people hear this, you and I saw the story the other day. They decided not to do this. They were going to hire social influencers. They were going to pay each one of them like $2,000 or something like to stop this misinformation from getting out.
Yeah.
To sort of stop. Because what happens is somebody will send up, oh, did you hear so-and-so just got shot by the cops? He was unarmed. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, run out in the street and start setting things on fire. So they said, well, we want these social influencers to, I guess what they had to do is stop misinformation. I don't know what misinformation is. Will it get to the autopsy that was done by the Floyd family? That one. And then there's the autopsy that was done by the county medical examiner, who also said it was basically a heart attack. And included in there was the fact that he was in a prone position and being held there. The right. idea that the Floyd family comes in, no. It was an asphyxiation through the obstruction of the airwaves, and here's the proof of this. So then which one do you take? You end up taking the county medicals one, but then you could say, oh, well, that's corrupt and this and that. You could start to facts don't matter in this case. Who do you choose? You choose the Floyd family over the other one, and then they're just trying to cover it all up. The lack of trust in all institutions across the board will be evident, I believe, in the next couple of weeks. We'll see this happen. Do you agree?
Yeah, and I
disagree.
And the reason they dropped that plan, though, is I think is now it's going to be televised. You don't
yes.
spinning will not be as easy to do, or spinning fabrications or defending yourself from spinning fabrications when everyone's eyeballs will be on it. We may all have different opinions about it, but I think that's why they ended up dropping it. Now, the one John, I know I hear the music, so we'll just have to do this quickly. Do you think that by having it televised, that it will distort the trial at all? Because I am happy it's going to be televised, but I do accept the fact that people can play to the camera and get awfully theatrical. And I'm just wondering if it's going to distort what's going to happen, or do you think it'll clarify what's going to happen?
I think it's the best thing for this case.
Okay.
I think it's the best thing for this. Whether they get cute and, whether all of a sudden all the publicity goes to the head of the prosecutor or the defense or we run into the same thing we did before with O.J. Simpson's case.
Yes.
I think it's necessary to be seen, but I think it's going to, whatever the verdict is, and if they're not able to get the guy on second degree, you'll see riots all over the place. And you will see tons of Democrats come out in support of this. And it'll be evident of a corrupt system that is constantly giving the shaft to black people. That will be the narrative, which is already set and ready to go. I think they need this case. I would think they would like to see this case blow up where the officer doesn't get convicted of second degree. That will do more for the agitators than if he is found guilty.
Wait, you mean you think that the prosecution wants to lose the case to
the prosecution doesn't. No. They want to win. It's a feather in their cap. I'm saying the city of Minneapolis. I'm saying
activists,
the people that
social
need
justice.
This. Yeah. Yes, they need this. Right. Just like Marx needed the middle class to rise up. They need this.
That's awfully cynical, I understand. Yeah, the ramifications of this case could be larger.
They don't care about George Floyd. George Floyd represents something. They don't care about this police officer.
He represents something.
They've made him represent something. This case specifically is about George Floyd, and the police officer has nothing to do with race, but they've taken this and blown this into a bigger thing. The people that would like to see the entire system torn down and rebuilt in a vision that is more progressive and more equitable. I believe it will do them better if the jury finds the police officer not to be guilty of second degree.
But that's because you think this case has nothing to do with race.
You show me there's zero evidence that it does, but that doesn't matter. That's not what's important.
It very well could. We'll have to see what the trial presents.
No facts to say it is. Tracy Taylor? Hey, everybody, here we go. You can write to us at mynorthwest.com. You text as well at 98973. be a big part of the show. Teeny tiny lady in her wooden wagon comes in with, I understand, a new horse that Sean will be telling us more about later on. We get closer to the big moment, the big reveal. A horse that Sean has helped to
rehabilitate.
You help rehabilitate. You broke it. Something. We'll find out more from Sean in a bit. But first, good news, Tom. That. That we're not supposed to chase happiness the way we thought we were supposed to chase happiness. Obsession with happiness is making our kids miserable. And I would say making most people miserable as well. It is the most sort of walked through area of books and bookstores is the whole sort of self-help happiness section, often colored in bright yellow or orange.
Yeah,
it
pastel.
It is one of those Googled pastels.
Easter people colors. Go there,
how to be happy, how to be happy. And this article basically says that we're doing a great injustice to our kids by trying to have them see that as the goal in life.
Yeah, I think that as an end result, that may be ideal, that we are individually happy. In fact, I think most parents probably wish more than anything else that our kids will be happy more than being successful or whatever. It's happiness, I think, is it's a value. But the suggestion here by this doctor writing this article in the Washington Post about how our kids are being made miserable by our obsession with happiness, it makes sense if you are harping on happiness, and they mention these, you know, those artsy house rule signs, and they one of them is be happy. And she points out that nobody is ever made happy by being told, be happy, shape up and be happy. That by insisting that we need to be happy, it's like, don't cry. It's like, don't acknowledge your feelings. Whatever you're, the only thing that's acceptable is feeling happy. So knock it off if you don't feel happy. And the doctor says in this article, the suggestion is that no, the point of it is, you know, we all go through hills and they have hills and valleys, and we have to appreciate and relish the valley so that the hills and the mountains that we ascend to can be seen in perspective, that part of a happy life is to have moments of unhappiness, because things cannot be always perfect. And during a pandemic with a lockdown, if you're not going to school, there are all these frustrations that kids, not we're putting adults aside right now, all the frustrations, they have to be acknowledged and accepted and sort of you know, mulled over, put in perspective, but not to deny them that kids have enough emotional problems already, feeling it, oh my God, I'm not doing something right because I feel down. It's okay to feel down. It's okay to feel scared. It's okay to feel all these things, as long as they don't dominate your entire worldview as a kid.
Happiness is can never be the direction or the byproduct of an effort. I heard Jordan Peterson say this once, and I thought this was really brilliant. He said that it is almost like grace. It is something that you receive that is with you only temporarily after you are doing something that is right, that you are being your best self at that time. And in effect, it is a reward, temporary as it is, that it's saying to you, yes, what you are doing right now is right or the best for you. Not sort of a salacious happiness or something that is, you know, getting something from, you know, doing something that would be considered to be not in your best nature or self, but an act. Like the other day, I said that you, I don't know if you were here, Tom, and I said I had a great weekend. I experienced unbelievable happiness helping this lady who was stuck on the side of the road with her car, and a bunch of us got out of our cars and helped pull her out.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, for about 25 minutes while walking around the Safeway store, I told Jacob, Matt, you might have heard this as well. There were four of us that all ended up at the Safeway store there in Cle Elum. And the one guy is coming down the aisle, pushing his cart. He's got some beer and a couple of he's the one of the guys that helped pull the woman out of the car, out of the ditch with me. And as we walked by, we just high-fived each other and kept right on going. It was this moment of, like, for 25 minutes, I was in a state of grace or happiness. I didn't set out to, I'm going to help her to be happy. That was the byproduct of the action that you're doing the best you can. So don't aim for happiness. You will receive it as your sort of thanks for coming by and doing something good. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, no. In fact, they often say that when people are depressed, the best thing to do is when you're feeling sad about your life and yourself, go out and do something for somebody else. And it's almost a guarantee that sort of sharing, you make feel like there's a purpose for me in life. I can help somebody else. That helps you lift that depression. Now, obviously, there's serious clinical depression and it's not so easily fixed. But a lot of times, if you can get out of your own head, if you can get out of your own worries, that actually helps you, you know, bring more perspective to your worries by helping others. And that's exactly what you and those guys did with that car. Good job.
That was a great feeling. Yeah. And then the other one was I was with Rye the other day, and he played for me talking to the tower at Boeing Field. And I was like, oh, my God, he's going to play this, and I'm going to cry because it's going to be he's going to sound so good. Here it is.
Montgomery Tower, Mooney 904 Kilo Sierra, ready for departure 28 left. Request left downwind departure when cleared.
And I thought, wow, does he sound like a girl? No.
Well, he's high up, right?
No, that's some, I just found that. That's some woman calling the tower. But when he called the tower, Tom, it was like, that's my kid, right? Yeah. And the tower responds, Kilo out of 0914, hold steady, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, look at you, Roll. And he's like, yeah, that's what you do. And then he looked over at me like, don't cry because you'll ruin the whole thing. But, you know how it is. Come on, Tom. You're with me on this, right?
Absolutely. Yes. There's nothing that makes parents happier than to see their kids doing something well.
Yes. Listen to the two of us getting all weepy on this. But that, you know, whether it's a kid at 9 years old, where I only had one pitch, which was the one in the middle. And then, you know, sometimes kids would hit it. Sometimes they'd strike out. Or your kids succeeding or anybody succeeding. Even Jacob, I feel like, when he goes in and uses the bathroom and washes his hands, and I'm like, good for him. That seems
I didn't even have to remind him.
No, I don't. I'm just getting all weepy when I see him in there going to the bathroom. All right, Tracy Taylor. Welcome back, Sean.
Thank you, John.
All right, everybody. The fact that high-tech Dine and Dash is forcing popular Korean fusion cafe to close. I thought Dine and Dash, you would go in, you sit down, you order the biggest thing you can. I've only done it once in my life, and I felt so guilty.
Well, that's good.
I never did it again, and I kept thinking, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to dine and dash, and then I'm going to get, like, trichinosis and isn't that where you get lockjaw? Isn't that lockjaw? Yeah, trichinosis. And I thought that's going to be the death of me. Here's how people are doing it now, in case you've never done it before.
Korean fusion cafe Spoon by H had the ingredients to become an L.A. success story.
During the weekend, it was, you know, line out the door.
The food is amazing. It's one of the best food. We actually come from Orange County.
But this is the epitome of a small business. Owner and chef Yunjin Hwang started her restaurant from her love of food and works 15-hour days running it with her mom and brother.
We have no staff. We have no cooks. I have to do everything by myself. Like so many other, you know, small businesses, like we were hit hard by the pandemic.
With so many new takeout orders online and through apps came a new challenge called friendly fraud or chargebacks. It's when a customer orders food, often through a delivery service, receives it but disputes the charge with their credit card company to get a refund. One day, Yunjin got her biggest order ever for more than $700.
He came and then he picked up the food. And then 1 week later, he disputed a charge.
She lost everything, the food, the money, and it kept happening over and over.
I just felt so, you know, incredibly helpless and frustrated.
So she made the decision to close up shop for good. Saturday will be her last day, much to her customers' dismay.
When I found out it was closing, I was just devastated.
But patrons saw her struggles and stepped in to help, raising more than $60,000 on a GoFundMe page.
It's been wonderful, like, reminder that there's more good in the people, like, around us and in our community.
How about that? Wow.
So infuriating, though, that people would do that. It's just like an exaggerated version of what we heard last week about tips are down for people, which seems odd. I mean, I've never tipped more than I have during the pandemic because we realize how tough it is for people in the restaurant industry, the food industry, to pull this off. To think that you would actually screw somebody out of $700 order, even. Oh my God!
You think they know though, Tom? You think the person that's doing that? I think they think, oh, the credit card company eats that. They probably think, yeah, they're a big bank or they're a big corporation. It's not going to come back on them. It's the same way when people steal stuff. And, well, just put on your insurance. Oh, just the insurance. You know, I remember one time my car got broken into. A friend of mine goes, what'd they take? I said, nothing. Oh, yeah, they did. They took golf clubs. They took a pair of alligator shoes. I'm like, no, they didn't. Yes, they did. Not with me. And I'm like, no. They took a washer and dryer. I said, what the hell? How big is this car? Oh, yeah, put everything. You got all sorts of stuff in there. I'm like,
you need to upgrade your friends, John.
This was a long time ago.
Okay.
Yeah. My friend Bob
Holly. It's just, maybe people don't realize.
It wasn't Bob Holly. It was Bob Nolly.
Yeah, that's right.
there we go. I think just going to get benefit of the doubt. I don't believe they think, well, I'm going to screw that Korean restaurant so badly that they go out of business. I bet they think, oh, that's the credit. Oh, they can afford it. That's the credit card company. They just eat that loss, whatever that's supposed to mean. That happened to me with my credit card, and I got my Venmo account got canceled. That's why I haven't been able to send Jacob $20 for no reason.
Oh.
And then Venmo sends me a letter saying, hey, $740 was charged back. And then it says, we, meaning Venmo, we are out $740. What are we supposed to do about that? That was the letter from the, it sounded like coming from like my neighbor down the street. This was from a corporation. So I wrote back, I said, I don't know what you're supposed to do, but I had the card stolen. They wrote back, if you want to unfreeze your account, you've got to make it right with us and give us $740 to open your account back up again. So they're not eating it.
Well, they are eating it if you decide you're not going to avail yourself of their services. That's interesting.
That's true.
So credit card companies, maybe they do. I don't understand enough about the way Venmo makes money as opposed to the way credit cards make money, but the credit card companies. But I would think
they take a little piece of it. They take a little piece of it, but then everybody's taking a piece of it. Venmo takes a piece of it, right? Because it's instant to Jacob, and then I'm putting it on my credit card, so I pay my credit card company. 3% or whatever they get charged. But Venmo's, it's quick to Jacob right away.
Yeah, I see.
So I now, to get my account back open again, I got to pay them $740.
Is there an alternative to Venmo? I mean, is there a Venmo-like operation you could then try? And
there are other ones, but the problem is nobody else has it.
Yeah, right. So it doesn't work.
It's like
work,
the first guy that bought a fax machine. Hey, I'll fax it to you.
That's right. Okay, I guess you're out the money.
Please buy a fax machine so I can fax you something with my machine. That's the sound of a man back in 1984. All right, let's check in with Tracy Taylor. What's going on out there?